In this episode, we learn all about active noise reduction headsets with the founder and CEO of Lightspeed Aviation. In the news, Bombardier job cuts and CS-300 orders, the NASA Aeronautics budget request, United 747 retirements, and the FAA reauthorization bill stalls. We also have the winner of the John Mollison print. All that coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 390 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and sharing host duties this episode is aviation historian David Vanderhoof. Hey, David.
Hey, Max. Hey, folks. Looking forward to a good night. There's going to be ringing in our ears, or I guess we don't really want that given the subject matter, do we?
No, not this episode. Also with us, of course, is Rob Mark. He's a pilot, an aviation journalist, publisher of the Jetwine blog.
Well, good evening. And I know that we're going to be just moving along at light speed tonight.
Oh, that was a good one.
Oh, he was waiting for that one.
Yep. Shameless.
All right. Well, let's see. Max Trescott is with a client right now, although we hear that he's on his way back, so he may join us in progress. We'll see. And Rob, you've got a deadline or something tonight that you've got to work to, I understand. So you may only just be with us for part of the show.
Well, I think I will certainly be here to continue with the segment with Alan, but I don't know that I can hang around for all the rest, so sorry about that.
All right, got it. All right. Well, let's introduce our guest, Alan Schrader. He's the founder and CEO of Lightspeed Aviation. Lightspeed, of course, is one of the leaders in the areas of aviation headsets, or maybe these days we should call them wearable technology for pilots. Lightspeed introduced their first product in 1996 at EAA Air Venture, and they continue to develop other innovative products. Now, Alan has a civil engineering degree, an MBA. He started his career at Tektronix, where he learned about product development and operations. Alan left Tektronix to launch a startup company producing wireless headsets. And then after 5 years, he and some of his Tektronix co-workers started Lightspeed Technologies to design and make active noise reduction headsets. Alan, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Max. And great to be here and looking forward to joining you guys in geeky stuff as appropriate relative to communications, quieting, and generally good flying things.
That's great. Now, this is a topic that I don't think we've delved into at all in the past, so this will be interesting for all of us to get into just, you know, what is it that makes a good aviation headset, what's the technology involved, and so on. Now, this episode, we're going to do in a little bit different sequence. We're going to have our main topic with Alan first, and then we'll come back afterwards and do the news. So why don't we get started right away with Alan. Alan, let's ask this for starters. What interest came first for you? Was it aviation? Was it technology? Was it starting a company? Did you grow up as a little kid thinking about headsets? What was the interest that started all this for you?
Yeah, it really was. It was the entrepreneurial side that started it. In the first job that I took outside of Tektronix, I was a part owner of a company making communication products. In the aviation space, actually, it had to do with intercoms, portable intercoms. And so that got me really into the pilot world. And the business side was driving that. But as you guys know, they're good people. Pilots are just generally really good people. It was a great group of folks to try to understand and sell to. And along the way, they were transitioning from the old technology, the passive technology, into this new emerging active electronics. This dates back to 1990 and 91. And so then it was really the technology that was the opportunity creator for a different kind of business and a different delivery of value.
Now, we call these ANR headsets, active noise reduction. Maybe you can describe to us, Alan, the technology behind that. What is it that makes these work and reduces that background noise?
Yeah, in the simplest way, if you think of a sine wave, sound has energy and it's characterized as a wave with multiple frequency characteristics. But it's a wave that is the noise that's coming in on its way in. And in a normal passive environment, you put a plastic something on around your ears and seal it with an ear seal, and you can keep some of that stuff out. But particularly the lower frequency content of that external noise doesn't get stopped very well by a chunk of eighth or quarter inch plastic. And so that noise gets in, and that's really the experience of folks who started wearing passive headsets in the late 60s and 70s and 80s. It got quieter, but there's still a lot of noise, and particularly this very irritating low-frequency rumble. Irritating because it's very fatiguing, and irritating because it tends to mask our ability to hear softer consonant sounds, the S's and P's and the subtleties of speech, which, by the way, carry most of the information content. So if you wore a passive headset, you got some protection for sure from high levels of noise, but you were not very well isolated from fatiguing low-frequency sound pressure, and it made it more difficult to hear clearly the spoken word. So that was sort of the era of passives, and it turns out that pilots, more than many, many people, are subjected to a high level of low-frequency noise. And so the technology, the principal technology used, is very good at low-frequency, let's say under 600 hertz kind of noise, at eliminating it. And if you think of the sound wave, and you just draw yourself a little sine curve, as us engineers would be willing to do, if you could insert another sound wave in that same space, but instead of the curve going up and then down and looping like a big S, invert it and insert a sound wave that is the opposite of the existing present sound wave. And if you do that, then you create a valley of sound where there was a peak, and a peak of sound where there was a valley. And the sound pressure waves literally just collapse. They just are absorbed. The peak falls into the valley, and the valley consumes a peak.
So to capture this background noise that you're trying to cancel out, does the headset then have some kind of built-in microphone or some way of detecting that sound?
Correct. So there's a microphone inside most good active noise headsets, particularly in the aviation space, and that microphone is listening for the noise that sort of got through the cup. And so that's noise that's gotten inside. And then there's some circuitry that takes that noise and inverts it basically and reinserts it via the speaker, either a separate speaker or nowadays they're all done with a single integrated speaker. And so the microphone's listening, hears sounds, puts out an anti-noise signal, and the anti-noise signal, properly phased, creates the peak and trough sort of system I described that sucks the noise out.
Now, Alan, I have a pair of Plantronics gaming headset mic that I use occasionally for other things. Does that really work on the same principle? It is a noise. It's called a noise reduction headset. Does it really work on pretty much the same principle?
Well, it doesn't, because I don't think Plantronics makes any what we would call active noise reduction headsets. They all claim to be noise reduction because they have a noise reduction microphone. So the microphone that you speak into uses a diaphragm that has openings on the speaking side and the unspeaking side. And so the sound pressures on that diaphragm stay the same until you start talking. And when you start talking, the sound pressure on the front side of the microphone, the mouth side, is different than the sound pressure on the backside. And so it creates the signal that's created through the vibration of that diaphragm.
You know, actually, Alan, I have a – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's it. So it's a noise-canceling microphone, and they call it a noise-canceling headset, even though it doesn't have any acoustic noise canceling to it.
It can't drown out that train in the background, right?
Not too well.
What I was going to ask is, you know, of course, I'm a little older than some of the people. Oh, wait.
The train's
He's
back.
Still rumbling. Hey, by the way, it would have been great if you had an active noise headset. I'm literally wearing a Zulu headset right now just for really good mic communication. And so I'm not bothered by the train that could be going outside my door.
Huh, interesting.
Wow, it sounds like it's coming through your backyard.
Did you, Alan, did you plan this?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
What I was going to ask is that, I'm a little older than some of the other folks, but when I first started flight instructing donkeys years ago, we didn't wear headsets at all. I mean, we just didn't. It was cool to be out in a Cessna 150 with the windows open or in a Cub, and you'd wave to the people on the ground. And what I'm curious is now everybody you see flies with a headset, and I'm curious what made that transition, do you think, between old, really stupid instructors like me who never wore earphones at all to everybody wanting one now? I know everybody does. I just don't know when that all happened.
Well, I think back then you had the inconvenience of a hand mic. You had to talk on a radio, and you listened probably through a ceiling speaker, I presume. That's how you heard any radio communication. And so that made it hard to hear. I mean, it just made it hard to communicate out. You had to use your hand to hold onto this hand mic, and you had to listen and strain to hear what some yahoo was saying from ATC. And so the convenience of a headset was simply that the speaker was delivered now directly to your ears. You didn't have to strain to hear it. And it was acoustically enhanced by the fact that you had this passive attenuation. But the bigger convenience was the microphone, because now you just had a push to talk someplace. You didn't have to waste a hand holding a microphone, and you could just speak right into the mic, and bingo, you were heard and heard clearly.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay. All right. Well, that works for me. Of course, I can't hear things these days like
that. Yeah, that's the other problem, right?
Big open room and that sort of thing, and those subtle sounds that you mentioned earlier just kind of get lost in the noise.
Yeah, that's just hearing exposure loss, which lots of folks who flew a lot back then, you didn't know what you were doing, but that's what you were doing.
So if I had a light speed headset and I wore it when I was out in a restaurant, say, I mean, do they have separate power packs that I could carry the battery with me and wear my headphones, and then I could hear people talking across the room?
Well, so it's just sort of working at counter purposes, because yes, you could block out a lot of the noise, but the speaking voice of people across the room would still be somewhat attenuated by the muff, by the thing you're wearing over your ears. So there are ear plugs that you could buy that have some filter capability that allow you to hear certain voice ranges, and it dampens out most of the noise, but it lets in voice range information, and those are pretty inexpensive and actually, not a bad way to provide some hearing enhancement of speech frequencies.
Hearing enhancement. I like the way you said that. Thank you.
Yeah.
can we talk about the other part of this?
I'm sorry.
What's that, David? Well,
the mic, how does the mic fit in compared to, what makes a good mic? Now, I'll warn you, Alan, I come from a call center background. So mics and earphones are from your previous universe. But what makes a good mic? We've talked about noise canceling for the earphones, but preventing the mic from picking up the noise from the cabin.
Yeah, so everybody these days, and really all days since David Clark first came out with their stuff, moved from in the old World War II days, they used a carbon mic, which is sort of like a speaker in reverse. It was a big cone with a magnet, And as you shouted into it, you moved the cone through the magnet, and the coils that were attached then created an audio signal, an electrical impulse that became an audio signal. But, you know, think about just trying to push with your voice pressure a coil through a magnet. That's, you know, the ability to discern soft, small instances of communication is pretty poor. So in the 70s and 80s, everybody moved to what's called an electret microphone, which is what I described before. It's a very thin diaphragm suspended with a little transistor on it. And so small elements of voice sound pressure create movement on the diaphragm, which creates a signal, and that goes through a preamp, which is the preamp you can tune with the C's and R's in there to create a certain type of side tone characteristic. But forever now, decades and decades, nobody's using dynamic microphones anymore. You can buy them on a David Clark 1030, but that's the only headset in aviation, I think, that you can buy with a dynamic mic. Everything is an electret mic, and so voice quality is very high, and noise rejection is pretty good. There's various techniques that are used to provide some isolation of the front part of the talking mic to the back part of the mic, but it's really quite straightforward and pretty inexpensive.
Alan, let's go back to the early days at Lightspeed. What was it like forming the company, and what was kind of the mood? What was the objective that you and the guys working with you had? What were those days like?
Yeah, well, they were, you know, those things are always a combination of scary and exploratory and in looking back, fun. But a lot of it was just trying to figure out how to get a business and a product started. I was fortunate to have really two partners. One was a technology specialist in active noise reduction, and the other was sort of a manufacturing and finance partner and friend. And so collectively, we did our thing. I knew about the markets and the customers. I knew about things that I thought could be done to make them more comfortable, a better wearing, using product. And the acoustic engineer was very good. It turns out probably one of the best in the world at the time in designing active cancellation systems. And so, you know, we went out doing that. It took us a couple of years to get the first product developed because we all had day jobs.
Oh, I see.
While we were doing that.
Oh.
And I was working in a company called Lightspeed Technologies, which ultimately is why we became Lightspeed Aviation, but was working away at this. And eventually we had a product ready that we launched and started selling in 96 at AirVenture. And for 3 years, then Lightspeed Technologies was selling an aviation headset, which became sort of the Lightspeed headset. And right at the end of 99, I made a decision with my technologies partners to just leave that business, which was a wireless one-way audio business, and just go off and just make aviation headsets. So Lightspeed Aviation sort of came into existence at the end of 99, and nobody really knew Lightspeed Technologies was the company in the beginning anyway. So they just thought it was a Lightspeed headset, and it stayed a Lightspeed headset, and who knew?
What was the biggest challenge? Was it getting the technology to work? Was it manufacturing the headsets? Was it the marketing and awareness and generating sales? What were the big challenges at the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, obviously for the first 2 years, as we're all sort of moonlighting, you know, the challenge was figuring out about the design, getting it tooled, getting it tested, getting the active noise to work well, because of the of Mike's involvement, the technology guy, we made a product in 96 that was pretty comparable to the best canceling headsets out there. And so there were some technology challenges, but I think the real business challenges became, how do we get our faces in front of people? How do we ultimately move from being Lightspeed who to Lightspeed somebody? And that, you know, that took a number of years. Thankfully, it's a relatively small market. So, the ability to reach people with magazines and also with trade shows allowed us to begin to build a little bit of a following about our company. And I was committed to running the company in a different way, in a way that really valued the customers on a long-term basis. And so we did a lot of things in the early years to care for our customers that weren't typically done, and frankly have continued to do that just in the ways we service and support the headsets. We've built a very nice reputation as a company that cares and does amazing things to service its long-term and faithful customers.
I think as a non-pilot, the way that I first became aware of Lightspeed, I think, was through the Lightspeed Foundation. I would see these articles and stories about things that the foundation was doing, and I think that was actually my first introduction to the company. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the foundation and some of the kinds of things that you do through that organization, through that foundation.
Yeah, thank you. Well, no, and I'm thrilled, frankly, that that the foundation was an early entry point for you, because our focus on the foundation really was to, above all else, make sure nobody thought it was a marketing arm of the company. I had personally just a sincere desire to invest in the community that I live in, that being aviation. And there, you know, we're blessed with the gifts of aviation, but there are so many needs that people have all over the world relating to everything from food and medical kinds of service and support. And so I thought, hey, we need to reinvest some of what the company is earning in this market and engage these great organizations that are doing some amazing work from a mission standpoint, to lift them up and help them tell their stories so that they get more people excited about what they do and get more funding and on all that stuff. And so our focus was on growth and compassion and trying to pick organizations that are doing good work there. And so that's really how we started pouring dollars into something that I think, you know, should matter, and to use the things we have in aviation to matter for other people.
Yeah, very good. We had a little bit of interaction with some of our listeners who had some questions. Some of our pilot friends were interested in a few things, things like the price of A&R headsets and where that technology is going, and wireless and all of those kinds of things. From the beginning of our conversation, I think it became clear that, you know, these are not like my $35 Plantronics, much more sophisticated pieces of equipment. Are these generally considered kind of a high-end product for pilots, and will we see different price points in the future, do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, you still see that. You can get, I think, an active noise headset for $250, $300 now. And it's, you know, I would say it's credible. It's certainly not incredible in the way it delivers stuff, in the way it's, how comfortable it is, how quiet it is, the fidelity of the audio characteristics, both internal listening and microphone. You know, the efficiency of how it runs from a battery standpoint. There's lots of things that, to make a product that's really well refined and doing the very best jobs, takes technology and investment. And it's a small market we live in. And so that's, I think, part of the penalty from a price standpoint that you see in the really the best A&R headsets compared to just an A&R headset. But they do exist out there, and they work.
You must have some kind of a lab or something of that sort where you develop new products, do research. What is that like?
Yeah, it's actually sort of probably three different places in our facility. We've got a environmental chamber and thermal cycling and, you know, cable testing and sort of call it a equipment test lab. That would be maybe the best description of it, for various specialized testing of things. And then we have an acoustic lab, which is really focused on, it's actually a huge box that we built with these massive speakers in it, because, you know, the aviation environment is a very challenging environment from an overall noise level and decibel level. And so we had to have a way to simulate, how do we create 125, 130 decibels of noise.
Wow, and low frequency noise.
And that's right, exactly. It's got to be this low frequency noise. And so actually they got this whole thing built, but they can only use it after five because it sort of shakes the building that we're in. It's really obnoxious. But yeah, so there's an acoustic part that is sort of noise and sound related. And then there's what I'd call the refined acoustics and audio pieces, which are, you know, calibrated heads, properly calibrated and manufactured ears so that you can begin to test for the fidelity of the products over a range of performance characteristics. Because we're delivering quieting, we're delivering comfort, we're delivering fidelity. And each of those are sort of different tasks to engineer into the products. So that's really what the sort of lab part of it is. And then, you know, we spend oodles of time, obviously, working with pilots, several here, and then test pilots and others, to begin to test in real world conditions the things we tested in these sort of lab conditions.
You know, I have a marketing question for you, Alan. When I met Teresa at Oshkosh last year, she mentioned the headset trade-in program that Lightspeed has, which I thought was really interesting because I was going to take my old headset and throw it in the garbage. But as far as I know, you're the only manufacturer that does something like that. I'm kind of curious, what made you get started with that, and has that really made any difference?
Yeah, I think it. So what made us get started with that was a belief on my part. I mentioned earlier on in the conversation about figuring out unusual ways to serve our customers. You know, our mission statement is to create lifetime advocates, in fact, of our products and our way of doing business. And so early on, as we started innovating, if you had bought a 20K in 1997, in 2000, you now could get an improved version with auto shut off. Well, a lot of people said, "Hey, well, I want to buy one of those," you know. But I just bought a headset a few years ago, and I thought, you know, if you've made an investment in little old Lightspeed Who back in '97, I need to honor that. And so, tell you what, I'll give you half your money that you spent on that headset 3 years. I'll give you half of that back to buy a new product that has features you want. And it was really a way to honor folks that had invested in the company. Well, you know, along the way, then the K's became XLs, became 3Gs, became Zulus, became Sierras. And so, you know, we got now the long line of people, over 300,000 headsets we've made. And people at various points along the road want to jump in on the new technology. And so I just thought it was the right way to treat people. So that's why we put it in. Now, about 5 years ago, once Zulu came out, there were a lot of people who had good headsets that were not our headsets that said, "Hey, I'd like to get a Zulu." And so I said, "Well, okay, I guess we could take non-Lightspeed headsets in trade also, because we want to, you know, we want to add to our advocate group. We obviously want to sell more headsets, and we want people to join the family and stay with us. So I'll open another door to joining the family." And you can trade in a non-Lightspeed headset for a Lightspeed headset.
300,000 headsets. That's an enormous number.
Well, we've been at it 20 years, so.
Yeah, I guess. What is the scope of your market? Obviously, general aviation, but is it also used in commercial aviation?
Yeah, it can be. I would say, honestly, that we have built most of our following and most of our focus in the general aviation market. But the commercial market is a good market, and it's certainly one that's an adjacent market for us that we can leverage our brand and move into. And so that's, you know, that's an active part of our product roadmap, is to better understand the needs of those pilots, because they have a different noise spectrum. They have a different use model. And in many ways, it's a bit more of a tool than it is a passion enhancer. They're flying a bus, and the bus driver needs some.
Yeah.
So we've got to, you know, we've got to adjust what it is we give to them in ways that really make sense for their noise, for their use, and for their application.
Rob, do commercial pilots bring their own headsets, or does the company give them headsets?
No, most of the time we would have headsets in the airplane, depending on the company. You know, different planes tended to focus on different kinds of headsets. Certain manufacturers liked this one. Certain aircraft manufacturers liked that one. And then we just kind of took whatever they gave us. But we weren't really thinking a whole lot about it. But, of course, the noise, I found that, you know, when I flew turboprops, it didn't matter that I had one of those competitor headsets that was kind of olive green covered.
I've seen a few.
It didn't matter because I've got to tell you, after about, you know, 7-8 hours of flying at the end of the day, I had the worst headache I've ever had in my life. I was exhausted. And one day I remember somebody saying something about ANR and I thought, oh, what difference does it make? I mean, and then I flew with one and I went,
yeah. Amen.
Whoa. It really did make a difference. But, you know, I'm curious, too, since you're focused on the GA market, do you have any idea how many people buy more than one of your headsets to kind of outfit their airplane or for the family or that sort of thing?
Yeah, if you're an airplane owner, you know, you probably have a headset for every seat. And I would actually argue from all the people that I know that by now they have way more than one headset for every seat in their plane. Because what happens is that, you know, they had a four-place plane. They had four headsets 10 years ago, but then, you know, then they had an active noise one and nobody else did. And then the wife really wanted to have an active noise one. So that was okay. They got another one. And that's to sort of push the headsets back through the seats and out the back door into the hangar. Because as you buy a new headset, you keep displacing headsets in your hangar. I mean, in your plane. So, as plane, I mean, we figure about 2.5 headsets per pilot as just a round number of estimating some total usage out there. Obviously, I've got a couple of friends that have several planes and own a dozen headsets. So the numbers vary widely.
Alan, you mentioned that the, you know, the noise spectrum, if you will, in a commercial airliner, let's say, is going to be different than in a GA airplane. Now, do I understand correctly that you've recently become a helicopter pilot, and wouldn't that have a completely different noise spectrum of its own?
Well, it's interesting. Yes, it's true. I did a little over a year and a half ago now, became a helicopter pilot. That's been a lot of fun, but. You know, the noise spectrum in a piston helicopter, there's the noise of the engine, the piston part of the noise, and then there's the resonant frequency of the propeller. In a GA environment, that thing is, you know, the spinning, the RPM is high on the prop, and that creates quite a bit of the content of the noise spectrum. It's not as bad because the RPM of the rotor versus the RPM of the engine is, of course, different in a helicopter. And, you know, it's the blades are spinning quite a bit less fast than the engine is. But a reasonably similar noise spectrum, not depending on the size of the Lycoming in the helicopter, you'll get a very similar engine noise spectrum. And then the noise coming from the blades themselves are different, but in the same general genre of 2,600 RPM, two or three bladed prop in a fixed wing plane.
Am I correct in assuming there's no such thing as kind of a tunable ANR headset that can be used in different environments? Do you sort of got to, you know, go for the range across the environments that you're expecting to fly in?
Well, actually, that's not quite true. And, you know, we talked about this big sine wave of noise, and there's really three types of cancellation technology, two types and a variant. One is feedback cancellation, where the microphone on the inside of the headset is listening to the noise inside, creating an anti-noise, creating the electronics, creating then an anti-noise signal. You can also have a microphone on the outside of the cup with something called feed-forward cancellation, which is then a predictive cancellation of the external noise. So you're measuring it outside and predicting what it'll be like on the inside. And then actually we introduced a product a couple years ago, the PFX product, which uses something called streaming quiet, which uses feed-forward, but instead of being a fixed feed-forward, it's constantly adapting. And so it's always listening for changes in the noise. and then because of that, creating adjustments to the noise cancellation on an ongoing, on-the-fly basis for substantial changes in noise spectrum. Obviously, climbing out is different from cruise, different from you know, from coming into land. So, so there is that one product that uses technology that does actually automatically adapt, but pretty much no other ones do that.
Interesting. What do you see coming down the road? What kinds of things are you working on that I guess you're able to talk about that we can expect to see in the future?
Well, I mean, there's a few. You just saw us, or at least hopefully you saw us, introduce a product a couple, three, 4 months ago. The first really fully integrated premium wireless headset.
Right.
And that's that was a big technology breakthrough to allow that to work and work in a way that nobody found annoying echoing and delays in the audio signals. So that's that was a bit of a breakthrough in the use model for folks, and has a lot of application. But you know, it's a your preference kind of thing because it's slightly larger in size. So it's really a matter of your use model as far as whether you want to trade away. Quieting is similar. Trade-offs you make around having cords and sort of the inconvenience of that, but a slightly lighter weight headset. I mean, I think one of the areas that we have pioneered and continue to see as possibilities of even better flying, delivering a better flying experience, is the integration of this head-worn communications with cockpit information and sort of the cockpit experience. I mean, when you put on a headset, you're now in the flow of information that is starting, as you know, to be more and more available from the panel to you and potentially from you to the panel. Mm. So voice commands begin to be something that is potentially practical. You could think of it the other way as sort of speech to text, because we have the FlightLink app that we already use for voice recording. But you could ostensibly, potentially be able to have the text of what the controller just told you show up on your iPad. And so we start to have a window of connecting this head-worn device to the information systems out there. And instead of just having to do it visually, you could start getting audio cues, audible cues and or written cues. So those are all things that are possible, and we're the only company making an app and integrating the headset into the environment that way, specifically for the headset and audio alerts and stuff like that. So it's been an interesting space for us to consider. Of course, we're not in charge of so much of the stuff going on the other side of the panel.
Sure.
We're used to being a plug-in connection. And but I think there's ways that can evolve to create greater convenience, greater safety, that would ultimately be a part of the headset's utilization.
Yeah.
You know, I have another sort of marketing question, I guess, Alan. I mean, were you surprised to see that Sennheiser pulled out of the aviation market?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think it's sort of become a two-horse race for the premium headset market. I think ourselves and a small company located in Massachusetts have probably well over half of the total premium A&R volumes. And so it means it's really tough for other people trying to compete in the A&R space. And Sennheiser has been at it a long time, invested a lot of money, particularly in their S1 products a couple, 3 years ago. And so, you know, they're a big company. They look at return on investment and sort of say, hey, we got other places to put our money and effort. So it's not a surprise, although they were very committed, very long-term player in the market. So that's more of a surprise than Beyer Dynamic, for instance, who left the market after really only 3 years of trying. So it's tough. It's a tough market because it's small. And it's a tough market because if you got to build a brand in a small market, it's difficult.
All right. Well, Alan, we know you've got another appointment to attend to. We want to thank you a lot for coming on the show, talking to us about active noise reduction headsets. Tell our listeners where they can learn more about Lightspeed online.
Yeah, lightspeedaviation.com is our website link. If you're interested in the foundation, it's lightspeedaviationfoundation.org to learn more about that. And we'd love to, or you need to call in. One of the things that's different and unique about our company, I insisted from the start that you only get personal contact, personal service. So if you call our office, you're going to get a human to answer whatever question you have, whether it's a product question, whether it's, you know, how to buy something, or you just need to some ear seals or whatever it is, you can call us because we like to talk to you. Feel free to do the research online, but we want to be connected with our customers and with those who are, active pilots. And so call in and we'll be happy to serve you in whatever ways we can.
Oh, that's great. That's kind of unique these days and really nice to hear. So very good. Again, Alan, thanks so much for joining us.
Indeed. Well, thanks, Max, and thanks to all of you and to the listeners. Enjoy the rest of the program, and blessings on your week.
All right. Well, we have a winner in our contest to give away a John Mollison print. We talked about that two episodes ago and asked folks a question and drew a winner from the correct answers. Now, David, let me see if I can get this right. You check me out on this. Now, this print is got four aircraft signed by the four pilots of those aircraft. And David, tell me if I get this part right. It's the B-25 flown by Dick Cole and Doolittle, Bud Anderson's P-51B, Alan Rigby's P-51D, and Mari Magnuson's P-47. Did I get it right, David?
Yes.
All right. And the question we asked, David, why don't you give us the question again?
The question was, who was Bud Anderson's wingman and also said Bud Anderson was the greatest fighter pilot he had ever seen?
All right. And the correct answer?
Was Chuck Yeager.
There we go. Well, so we randomly selected a winner. And if we had a drum roll, this is where we'd play it. And our winner is Andy Travnicek. If I pronounced that incorrectly, Andy, very, very sorry. I think Andy is from New Hampshire. And we'll be contacting him. John Mollison graciously offered, well, not only the print, but to mail it out. So Andy can be expecting that. We want to thank everybody who responded with an answer to the question. We had quite a lot of entries. We'd also mention that John Mollison's artwork and historical contributions, including his Old Guys and Their Airplanes documentaries, can be viewed at oldguysandtheirairplanes.com. You can also find him at johnmollison.com. And if you'd like to go back and listen to the episode where we spoke with John, if you haven't heard it already, that's at airplanegeeks.com/388. Now we'd like to play a short recording sent in by listener John, and you'll hear right away how this fits in.
I really enjoyed listening to your conversation with John Mollison. I'd love to have a piece of his artwork on my wall, though I have to admit, it wouldn't be my most cherished wall hanging. Several years ago, I helped clean my grandfather's house when he moved into a retirement community. Buried in the back of his closet, I found a small box that contained a pocket watch, years' worth of pins from donating blood to the Red Cross, and a draft card dated February 16, 1942. Under the box, I found a folder with an old picture of a B-17. When I asked Grandpa about it, he said the picture was of his plane, taken by a friend over the South Pacific. With a chuckle, he said we could probably recycle the draft card. He doubted he'd be needing it again. With his permission, I kept both, and I hung them on my wall. After finding the B-17 picture, I became curious about Grandpa's younger life, and from then on would ask him about his service when I visited. He'd always change the subject, or make some quick quip about it being the most exotic vacation he'd ever had. That's about all anyone else in my family ever heard about it as well. About a year ago, I visited him and could tell something was different. His 93-year-old body was tired. I asked him again about his time in the war. This time he got quiet. He looked upset, and his eyes started to tear up. Not one to upset an old man, I apologized and changed the subject. With tears in his eyes, he looked at me and said, "You know, if the Japs could shoot any better, we wouldn't be here." He then cracked a slight smile and reminded me that he was the first of three generations of veterans. That really did make him proud. The next time I saw him, he was in a flag-draped coffin. The flag was folded. The honor guard presented it to my family with the parting words, "This flag is presented on behalf of a grateful nation as a token of appreciation for Thomas's honorable and faithful service." Interred in Michigan, next to my grandma, is another veteran whose story will never be told. I really enjoyed listening to your conversation with John Mollison, and I commend him for his work in telling some of the stories that might otherwise always go untold.
Thanks so much, John, for sharing that with us. Wonderful story. It really illustrates the significance of the work that John Mollison is doing. We really appreciate you telling it. We have a photo that John sent along showing the framed B-17 that's hanging on his wall. Be sure to find that in the show notes. I think you'll like it. Now we'll move on to the news. And as it turns out, it's still just David and myself. And so it's up to us. Our first news story comes from the Wall Street Journal. This is Bombardier to cut workforce by 10% and gets new C-Series orders. So maybe it's a kind of good news, bad news thing. Although some people consider it good news, depends on where you stand. In any event, Bombardier plans to cut about 7,000 jobs. This is from its worldwide workforce. So this is not just in Canada. Their workforce worldwide is about 71,000. Layoffs are expected to be in both Canada and in Europe. The Wall Street Journal reports that it's split pretty evenly between its plane and train operations, and also that around 2,400 cuts are expected in the Quebec area. That's job cuts, David. That's never good news for people who are concerned about employment, including the employees. But, you know, there are, I guess, some different kinds of reasons for it. Bombardier has got the C-Series development sort of winding down, if you will. I mean, they're in a different phase in that life cycle. I understand there's some train projects that are also kind of experiencing the same thing. So they don't have the requirements for as many employees as they did in the past. But they also mentioned a couple of other things. They also mentioned some cost initiatives that Bombardier is accomplishing, and also some supply chain improvements. They also note just a general slowdown in the demand for business jets. So that's the employment side.
Well, and it's interesting because we always forget that there's a whole other transportation side of Bombardier. And you know, we later on we're going to talk about fuel prices. Interesting enough, you know, when gas goes down here in the United States, you have lots and lots of people not talking about trains, and they buy cars, you know. And so for a while there, when the gas prices were spiking, there were more and more people buying trains, causing Bombardier to increase production. Now, public transportation here in the States, not so much, because people can afford cars and gas. Likewise, it's not surprising that there isn't a glut of or a reduction in people buying business jets. I mean, they've been a consistent production for the last 4 or 5 years, where they didn't really take a dip. And it's like everything else, there's a maturity to it, and there's nothing really Bombardier isn't coming out with anything a new product for the business jets. It's just maturation of the existing product line.
And then on the commercial side, the good news for the C-Series program is that Air Canada placed orders for 45 firm and 30 option CS300 airplanes. Now, of course, the CS300 is the larger of the two C-Series planes. The deal is valued at $3.8 billion. And as always, that's reported at list price. And, of course, we don't know how much Air Canada actually will pay for those. Bombardier's chief executive, Alan Bellemare, has said that, quote, this is a strong endorsement, and also that, quote, we are turning Bombardier around. They have a big task ahead of them. We see that fourth quarter last year, Bombardier lost $677 million, which is kind of tough. But the stock market reacted to the news here, the combined news of workforce reductions and orders, and the stock went up 21% as a result of that. Now that sounds like a lot, but it is a lot for a day or two in share price change. But when you look at the trend over the past 12 months, it's still down. The stock price is still down. I took a look, and it seems that in February 2015, 12 months ago, the stock was $2.35 a share. But at the start of February this year, it was down to 77 cents. And when I checked, including that 21% increase, but it's trading now at $1.14. So it's up, but not in the long run.
Well, we'll see. Air Canada is a start. You know, maybe that'll prime the pump and there'll be more purchases for the C-Series. We can only hope. And it's been a long road. Seems like this is another one of those things that we've been talking about forever.
Yes, yes. David, I did see an interesting item that relates to this kind of in The Motley Fool. And I hadn't heard of this before, that Bombardier is actually proposing a reverse stock split. So normally we see stock splits. This is a reverse. And if it's approved at the annual meeting at Bombardier, this reverse stock split would put the price back up between $10 and $20 a share. Now, you know, you can say that that's just, you know, changing the number of shares. Isn't that just artificially changing the stock price? And I mean, kind of, yes, it is, except that, as the Motley Fool points out, that eliminates the sort of the stigma of a really low stock price. It impacts investor feelings towards a company if the stock gets too cheap. So it's kind of an odd thing, you know, the stock market.
Or as we say in my industry, perception is reality.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a buyback. It's a buyback. We'll keep an eye on it. Should we go off to our next story?
Yes.
Which is, this was really good news. It's not often we get to hear the words NASA and budget approval and more money. This is from Wired.com. It's NASA wants to bring back supersonic X planes. NASA wants to get back into the A business, or, you know, aeronautics.
Aeronautics.
And they are going to start developing a X plane that is going to cut commercial aircraft fuel consumption in half, reduce emissions by 75%, utilize renewable energy, and reduce noise levels around airports, which has always been the big deal about supersonic transport. So we're getting a new X-plane, I hope.
I hope. Of course, the budget has to be approved, and we'll put a link in the show notes not only to this article in Wired, but also some information about the budget request. I thought it was very interesting. Now, this request is for fiscal year 2017, and the total budget for NASA, or the total budget request for 2017, is $19 billion, and they break it out into the different areas. And aeronautics, David, one of the A's of NASA, the request is for $790 million. And yeah, they want to do some, you know, some good things in terms of the what things that you mentioned, David. They also want to look at building this low sonic boom flight demonstrator, which is an interesting technology. Now, they're not the only ones who are working on this. Boeing and Airbus and Lockheed Martin and others have shown concepts for supersonic aircraft in the past few years. And of course, we've talked about the Ariane Corporation plans. They're looking to build a supersonic business jet around, I think, 2023. If you can come up with the magic way to shape the sonic boom so that it doesn't strike the surface, or it only does in a much more muted fashion, then that just opens up a whole new world of possibilities when it comes to supersonic airplanes.
I like the fact that there'll be more X planes. That makes me happy.
Yeah.
I'm so easily amused. I know. It's one of those things that we talk about with Bill, our favorite NASA historian. You know, he always thinks it's funny that I'm one of those few people who likes the A in NASA.
Yes, yes. Now, the first X plane, was that the Bell X-1?
Straighten me out, David. Well, the Bell XS-1 was the very first supersonic, and that's Glamorous Glennis. And then they decided to drop the S, and it became the X-1, followed by the X-1A, X-1B, and then the X-2, X-3, X-4, and thus the X-planes were created. But originally, there wasn't an X-plane. It was an XS-1, the first aircraft to break the sound barrier.
Piloted by?
Chuck Yeager.
There we go.
we could always say the second aircraft, because the week before an F-86 and a dive broke the sound barrier, but we don't talk about that.
It kind of doesn't count, right? I mean, well, it broke the sound barrier, but not in a powered mode.
Well, it was in a powered dive, yeah.
It was in a powered dive?
But it's sort of like other people saying that they first flew in Connecticut before the Wright brothers,
Okay.
Yeah, maybe, possibly, but we can't prove it.
If you don't have the photographer handy, then it doesn't count, right?
Yeah, David's rule of historical fiction.
Okay. Another item. This comes from a post by aviation journalist Brian Summers, who writes at briansummers.com. This is, United Airlines tells pilots it may retire all of its Boeing 747s by 2018. And we've talked about this a little bit, about the, I don't want to say the demise, but the fading away of the four-engine airplanes like the 747.
But Max, I mean, there's no other airplane that can fly like the 747. Why are we going to retire the 747s? You know, there's going to be no other airplane that can do what the 747 does. It has four engines, flies around the world. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. I was using the A-10 argument about that, wasn't I?
Oh, dear. Well, almost a year ago, United had indicated that its 747 fleet would be around for a while, maybe with a 2020 decision point that they might make based on aircraft maintenance requirements. Now, however, we see that pilots at United have been told that the 747 retirements may occur at a much faster rate. And as the article points out, maybe by 2018. Now, United says that if they do move to retire their 747 fleet quickly, they say they will accelerate deliveries of new wide bodies. So, yeah, why would they be retiring these? Well, you know, many of these are old airplanes. These are all 747-400s now. United had 22 of them, only 22 of them left at the end of 2015. But as they become older, the maintenance becomes increasingly expensive. They point out that as the number of aircraft decreases, it becomes more difficult to support them away from the hub, you know, out at the spokes. They become less economical, less of a smart business decision. As I mentioned, they have only 22 of them left. Of course, they had other smaller 747s in their history, in their fleet earlier, but those have all been retired. Replacing for wide bodies, United has both A350s and 777s on order. They have 35 A350-1000s. The deliveries start 2018 on those. And they also have on order 10 more 777-300ERs. Those deliveries begin this year in 2016. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, David, maybe the 747s will be gone, at least from United, in the not too distant future.
Yeah, unfortunate. But it is what it is. I wonder how many of them are Continental 747s versus United. It would be. I need Dan Webb, Fleet Master, to
give us
see what the breakout was. Yeah. But it's the same argument about what they were saying about the E4s and the VC-125s. They're all, and those are 747-200s. The chain isn't there anymore. You know, I mean, there's so few Intercontinentals coming off the 800Is or the 800Fs. There's really, you know, it's like computers. Eventually, they get stopped being supported. You know,
right.
I don't know what else to say. You know, I'll be very sad when the 747 disappears like everybody else. But gone are the days of four turning, two burning, or four turning, or six turning, four burning, or I don't know. I mean, it's kind of sad. It is very sad, but
it is.
These days come.
Yeah. And then one more news item from AvWeb. Reauthorization bill stalled in committee. Well, some people have been predicting this. Now, this is, of course, the
oh, come on. If you want to listen to this being predicted, you need to listen to UAV Digest from last week when I said this was going to happen, and the next morning it did.
You did. So the reauthorization bill, the AIR Act of 2016, has been meeting with lots of criticism, and it's come, as we've talked about, from many, many aviation organizations, particularly GA and business aviation organizations. The Democrats have been pretty much opposed to the bill as it stands now. And in fact, a number of Republicans have also expressed some concern about that. So as a result of all that, it's not going to be taken to the floor of the House this week as was originally planned, so that, well, they can take a look at it. And what that means is try to gather more support for it, look at making amendments to it that will make it more palatable to others. We don't know what will happen, but almost certainly it's going to affect what we see in the bill right now in terms of
ATC and UAVs and a lot of... It's getting fire from multiple sides. It's really kind of amazing. It's not often, Max, that we have one topic that crosses both shows.
Yeah, and this one,
you know,
does. Yeah,
and this one does. So it's kind of amazing. This afternoon I did something, and I recommend everybody here in the States to do it. I sent an email to my local House of Representatives representative and asked what his opinion was. I haven't got a response yet, but I'm interested to see what my local Republican representative has to say about this topic and involved with transportation and whether he's for it, against it, you know. And I think that maybe take 2 minutes. I mean, all I did was I looked up who my representative was. I knew that already, but I looked it up, looked up his homepage. There's a contact me form and send an email. Say you want to know what their opinion of HR 4441 is. And we all need to be proactive. And since it's staying in committee, we might get a chance to get the bill we want, not the bill they think we want. So I challenge all of our listeners here in the States, contact your representative and see what happens.
On this topic, we received a really great email from our listener, Kevin, and he made a number of different points. I think he sent this really before this AvWeb item had come out with a notice that the bill was going to be delayed going to the floor. But Kevin predicted that, he thought that this is going to be too difficult to resolve before the current legislation funding the FAA expires on March 31st. And he says, my guess would be a continuing resolution is passed extending funding on a short-term basis, which I think we're already living under one of those extensions. I think the 2012 Act expired last fall, if I remember correctly. And these kinds of continuing resolutions, if you're not familiar with American politics, are, they're
common, unfortunately.
Yeah. They can be used when they can't agree on what to do, but they've got to keep money flowing into something like the FAA. So the continuing resolution means everything stays just the way it is, but funding continues. Kevin made a number of other interesting comments. He says that part of his job is covering the congressional hearings, and having watched that for this bill, he has some interesting comments. He agrees with the troubling nature of users, that being the flying public, covering the costs of this operation in the event it becomes insolvent. He also mentions that the Republican from Indiana, who was one of the two Transportation and Infrastructure Committee Republicans that voted against the bill, made some really good points that centered around the effective majority the airlines would have under this proposed ATC structure. And he used a hypothetical scenario explaining that there's nothing in the proposed bill that would prohibit the board, assuming the majority of it leans in favor of the airlines, from limiting the number of fractional jet carriers like NetJets that compete on certain routes with the airlines in order to drive users of those services to fly first class on the airlines. Also raised some good points about the board representation. The definition of airline was kind of changed to include cargo as well as the mainline carriers. But with the proposed four airline board seats, they're airlines and not necessarily representatives of the cargo industry. So there's kind of the potential for poor representation there. Similarly, we've got, regional carriers, and it just the makeup of this board doesn't really seem like it ensures fair representation from all the stakeholders in air traffic control.
No, it's not. The deck's not stacked for the airlines. No. I'm kind of appalled that this is actually coming from a representative in my state. And I my other intention is to reach out to him to see if we can get him to comment on it. Let's hope it stays in. For once, I'm kind of happy that something's staying in committee, and let's get it right. And this is too important.
Yeah.
And
another aspect of this, David, in closing, on this topic, I think, is that the pressure that we've been talking about putting on the elected officials, we personally as individuals, through the organizations that we're members of, AOPA, the EAA, NBAA, all of them, it looks like it's having an effect. It's contributing to the, to the effect that we're seeing in the delay here. And that doesn't mean, though, that we should let up, that the job is done. It's really not. This is almost where, the good work really starts, because we need to take this bill, and it needs to be pushed and formed into something that's much more reasonable and much more broadly acceptable across the entire aviation industry. So don't, now is not the time to let up. All right, David, we've got kind of a special Airplane of the Week segment this time. What do we got here?
We got David being lazy.
Is that what it was?
No, in all fairness, sometimes you try to get people pressure you to do things that you don't want to do. And after my smart-alecky comments about the British Electric Lightning being ugly, which I still stand by, there was quite a few people who insisted that I needed to do it as an airplane of the week. And if anybody knows me well enough to know is, one, it's my segment and I'll write what I want to, and B, the more you pressure me to do something, the less likely I am to do it. Well, in this case, Glenn Taller in New Zealand was pressuring and pushing and pushing till finally I said, well, you want an aircraft of the week segment, you do it.
And he did.
And he did. And in all fairness to Glenn, I'm very proud of him. We're going to have some discussions about length going forward. But he did do it. And I guess we should roll that beautiful footage.
The English Electric Lightning, the airplane of the week by Glenn Taller. The English Electric Lightning, a classic British fighter and the first and only British fighter to exceed Mach 2, was designed to counter the threat from high-altitude Russian bombers, a point-defense interceptor which had tremendous performance, and it was originally built as a single-seater. The Lightning was designed by W.E.W. Petter, who was mentioned before by David in an earlier episode. He also designed the English Electric Canberra, a classic British bomber, which was modelled on the de Havilland Mosquito. But back to the Lightning. The only aircraft to have one engine mounted above the other, which caused some problems with engine fires. If one engine caught fire, then the pilot would have to eject, as the fire was quickly spread to the good engine, turning the aircraft into a flying brick. The swept-back wing design was also very new and met some scepticism by many at RAE Farnborough. But after wing tunnel testing, it found to be a sound design. The specification for the Lightning came about because the RAF had cancelled the Miles 52 supersonic fighter back in 1942, leaving the way open for the Lightning. The original specification calls for a fighter capable of reaching Mach 1.5, which even the early models could exceed. The P1, which is not yet called the Lightning, are only allowed to fly at Mach 1.5 due to directional stability issues. The later versions, of course, were true Mach 2 machines, the P1 also having the Armstrong Whitworth Sapphire engines, which had no afterburners. These were soon replaced by the Rolls-Royce Avon engines, which had four-stage afterburners, were much more powerful and reliable engines, and these were used in all production models from F1 onwards. The original role of the Lightning was to defend the V bomber force from attack, giving them time to take off and bomb targets in the Soviet Union. The Lightning only ever scored one kill in its service with the RAF. That was of a BAE Harrier, which the pilots have ejected from, but the aircraft kept flying. This was over Western Germany. There are rumours, which were published in a book called The Lightning Boys by Richard Pike, that a Lightning flown by an American pilot shot down a C-130 Hercules, which had been stolen by an American tech sergeant and who tried to fly it back to the US. But nothing has ever been confirmed by the US Air Force or the UK Ministry of Defence. The Lightning first flew as the P-1 on the 4th of August 1954 by the very famous test pilot Roland Biermont, and was introduced into service in December 1959. The first model in service was the F-1, which had an armament of two Firestreak missiles and a pair of Aden 30mm cannons, and a Ferranti AI, which is air interception, -23 radar. Later, these were modifications done to this aircraft, and these versions were called F-1A, F-2, F-2A. These aircraft had only small modifications, but only when the F3 version entered service did large differences appear, including an upgraded SADAR system, new engines, and red-top air-to-air missiles, and the Aden cannons were removed. The tail was also clipped due to the aerodynamics for carriage of the red-top missiles, The F3 was the first true Mach 2.5, and previous versions were only allowed to fly at Mach 1.7. The F3A was also a single-seater and a larger fuel tank, extending the range by some 800 miles, and also had a new wing, which improved maneuverability at higher altitudes, and an extra fuel tank which doubled the available fuel. Then came the T4 trainer, which added an extra seat in a side-by-side configuration, like the Jet Provost and the BAC Strike Master. This was based on the F1A, and later there was a T5 version, which was based on the F3 and retained the side-by-side seating of the T4. The ultimate version of the Lightning was the F6, which was basically an improved version of the F3, which improved subsonic performance and handling and included overwing fuel tanks and brought back the twin Aden cannons. There was to be an F7 version, which never went into production, would have had a variable geometry wing like the Tornado and the F-111. It also had underwing hardpoints, new radar and cheek-mounted air intakes. Also carry Skyflash air-to-air missiles, but never made it off the drawing board. Another version which was meant to enter service was a Sea Lightning FAW-1, which was a similar design to the F-7, but of course also never made it into service either. The Lightning was very advanced for its time, as the aviation author Kev Darling put it, never before in flight an aircraft being so dependent on electronics. Electricity was provided by a bleed air-driven turbine housed in the rear fuselage, which drove in turn both AC and DC generators. It also had a 28-volt backup emergency battery. It also had Dunlop disc brakes and Irvine air chute braking parachute. Irvine being famous for the parachutes made during the World War II for aircrew, not just for British but German aircrews, but that's another story. Towards the end of its service, the Lightning was increasingly outclassed by more modern aircraft with better radar and armaments. There was much talk of upgrades, but nothing ever came of it, including the fitting of AIM-9L Sidewinder air-to-air missiles. Export versions. There were many built as private venture by British Aerospace and were more capable than the RAF versions. They were fitted with hardpoints for weapons such as Sneb rocket bombs and 5 reconnaissance cameras carried in a ventricle pack in the forward fuselage. The trainer version was also combat capable, unlike the RAF versions. The Lightning F-52. Slightly modified ex-RAF F-2s were exported to Saudi Arabia. Only 5 were converted. The F-53, export version of the F-6 with pylons for bombs and rockets. A total of 46 were built. 34 were sold to Saudi Arabia and 12 to Kuwait. One aircraft crashed before delivery. And T-54, there's 2 ex-RAF T-4s. And the T-55, with 8 built, 6 were sold to Saudi Arabia and 2 to Kuwait. Climb. This is what the Lightning was most famous for. And there were many air shows that would go along the runway at about 50 feet. The pilot would light the afterburners, pull back on the stick, stand the aircraft on its tail and climb like a rocket. With a climb rate of some 20,000 feet a minute and a service ceiling of excess of 60,000 feet. This was an official secret while the aircraft was in RAF service, but there are reports of Lightnings climbing to 88,000 feet and intercepting U-2 spy planes. Speed. During British Airways trials, Concorde was offered to many European air-based air forces as a target for them to intercept. F-15, F-14, F-16 and Mirages all tried to catch and overtake, but only one Lightning managed to overtake in level flight from a stern chase. XR-749 was described to the pilot as a very hot ship. Operational history. As I mentioned before, the Lightning had excellent performance and armament was effective, but there were a lot of teething problems when entering operational service. But after a few months, these were soon overcome. 74 Squadron, which was the first to use Lightnings in operation, and in 1961 they were appointed the Official Fighter Command Aerobatic Team, flying air shows throughout the UK and Europe, famous for their Diamond 9 formations. The Lightning was used by R11 Group Fighter Command in the UK. It was also used in Singapore by the Far East Air Force from 1961 to 71. The Near East Air Force had a base called RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus, a base which was used a lot at the moment for airstrikes over Syria. The Lightning first arrived in 1967 and saw service until 1975. The RAF Germany, which included two squadrons, 19 and 92, until 1979, which when they were replaced by F-4 Phantoms. Other countries to buy Lightnings, as we mentioned before, were Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. The latter were needed to improve their air defences owing to the involvement in the North Yemen Civil War. Of course, not too different to what's happening today in that area of the Middle East as we speak. On the 21st of December 1964, a series of orders were placed with Britain and the US to build an integrated air defence system. British Aerospace received orders for 34 multi-role Lightning F-53s and 6 T-55 trainers. But then Egypt started bombing Saudi Arabia, so a more urgent order was placed in March 66 for 6 ex-RAF Lightning F-2s and 2 T-4 trainers. This contract was known as the Magic Carpet. The aircraft were delivered in July of 1966. There were also 6 Hawker Hunter jets delivered, and these aircraft were flown by mercenary pilots who soon curtailed even the Egyptian air operations. The F-53s were handed over to the Royal Saudi Air Force in December of 67, but they stayed in Walton where they were used for trials and development, and the first Saudi Lightnings left Walton where T-55s in early 1968 were used at RAF Cottesshore to train Saudi pilots. The new build Lightnings were delivered under Magic Palm between July 68 and August 69. The multi-role F-53s served in a ground attack, reconnaissance as well as air defence role, right up until 1971 when the Northrop F-5 Tiger replaced it in the ground attack role, leaving the Lightning to concentrate on the air defence role and some reconnaissance. On the 3rd of May 1970, one Lightning was shot down during a border dispute with South Yemen while carrying a photo reconnaissance mission. The pilot was rescued by Saudi forces. Up to 1982, the Lightnings were operated by 2 and 6 squadrons, and some were with 13 squadron. But when the F-15 Eagle entered service, all Lightnings were grounded and put into storage. As part of the deal to buy the Bravania Tornado, BAC bought all of the 22 airworthy examples, and these were returned to Walton, where all Typhoons are built in the UK at this moment. These aircraft were offered to Nigeria and Austria, but none were sold, and all were sent to museums. Kuwait ordered 14 Lightnings in December 1969, comprising of 12 F-53Ks and 2 T-55Ks, but these aircraft did not see much service, as they were complex to maintain, and Kuwait didn't purchase from BAC and Airwork Services the maintenance contracts to keep the aircraft in the air. They did try to sell these aircraft to Egypt in 1973, but the deal fell through and the aircraft were destroyed in 1990 at the start of the first Gulf War. The final years. The Lightning was pretty much at the end of its useful life when it was phased out of service between 1974 and 1988. The F-4 could carry far more weapons and fly much further than the Lightning. The Spedcat Jaguar was replaced in the F-4 in the ground attack role, so freeing up more F-4s for air defence. The direct replacement for the Lightning was actually the F-3 Tornado, which also never shot down an aircraft in RAF service. So ended the military service of the only Mach 2 British fighter. General characteristics. Crew 1. Length 55 feet 3 inches. Wingspan 34 feet 10 inches. Height 19 feet 7 inches, wing area 474.5 feet. Empty weight 31,068 pounds. Maximum takeoff weight 45,750 pounds. As I mentioned before, power plant is two Rolls-Royce Avon afterburning turbojets with a dry thrust of 12,530 pounds, thrusted afterburner 16,000 pounds. Maximum speed Mach 2, which is 1,300 miles an hour at 3,600 feet. Range 850 miles. Supersonic inset radius 155 miles. Ferry range 920 miles or 1,270 miles with ferry tanks. Service ceiling 54,000 feet. Zoom ceiling 70,000, but of course there has been aircraft that have gone higher than that. Rate of climb, as you mentioned before, 20,000 feet. Armament, as I mentioned before, two Aden cannons. Hard points, two under-fuselage mountings for two air-to-air missiles, and two overwing pylons for 260-gallon ferry tanks. Missiles were two de Havilland Firestreak or two Hawker Siddeley Red Tops. And that's it.
Well, I'd like to thank Glenn for taking the time to do that. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of work. He sent me the script, and I said, "But where's the recording?" He then went back to his desk and did a really half decent job. And as a first attempt, he did a really good job. So, Glenn, thank you for doing that. Again, though, we need to talk about your length. And I'd like to thank Max for helping me edit this. With that, we'll move on. And next week, we'll got something even a little more special for me. I was asked to review a book from the Smithsonian. So that's what we'll be doing next week.
Oh, can't wait for that. All right, moving on to listener mail. We have time to do a couple of the many, many emails we've received. Want to thank everyone for sending them in. As we've said time and again, we read them all. It's difficult to answer all of them because just of the volume that we receive. It's a good news, bad news kind of a thing. We love the feedback, but it's hard to personally respond to all of it. But we heard from Kent. He writes, thanks for the response to his recent email. He said he saw Aunt Benet flip this on Flipboard a few days ago. This is an article from CNN. Airfare is finally getting cheaper. And it talks about the airfare rate. This is some data that comes from the Department of Transportation that says in the third quarter, so that would be in 2015, domestic airfare dropped 6.2%, making it the cheapest since 2010. Article mentions some of the reasons for this. I think if you're interested, we'll have the link in the show notes, but it talks about competition from low-cost carriers. The big one, the oil prices coming down. There's some questions that kind of arise from that. David, one thing that occurred to me is, if we had a crystal ball that was any good, it'd be nice to know what was going to happen to oil prices. Are they going to stay down? Are they going to rise again? And if they do go back up, will they go back up to the levels that we've seen in the past or even higher? These kinds of questions, they throw a real monkey wrench into the planning of airlines and transportation companies in general, and any industry that relies heavily on fuel, or where fuel prices or fuel costs, let's say, are a significant portion of the total expenses, it makes things really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's hedging. I mean, and the airlines hedge their bets. You know, we had Delta went out and bought a refinery. You know, and who knew that gas was going to, or Avgas was going to be so cheap now after they went out and bought a refinery as a way to save some costs. So it's going to be an interesting thing because it's really cheap fuel is a really indication of a not so good economy. But we've got a lot of countries out there that are for once driving the fuel costs to the ground instead of trying to pump them up. We've come a long way since the 70s in OPEC when they had everybody under a did I just say under a barrel?
yes, you did.
Sorry. But gas is this is the lifeblood of any aviation organization, and
sure.
It's interesting what they're doing, and eventually it's going to bottom out and start going back up again, and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, I guess.
I don't know. I'm not complaining when I fill up my car and it's under $20 to fill it up. I know that that's not the way the rest of the world works, but it helps my economy. Yeah, so
we're enjoying that here now, that's for sure. We also heard from Mike Harris. He wrote us and said, thanks for another great episode. He was listening to episode 389. He says, I enjoyed the favorite airplane segment. Got a laugh to hear my vote for the Piper Tri-Pacer mentioned with all those legendary airplanes. Mike says, it sounded like my Tri-Pacer vote caught David by surprise, too. Sure, it's a far cry from a fighter jet or airliner, but as a fairly new pilot and brand new owner of a nice Tri-Pacer, it gets my vote every time. He says, I love my new Tri-Pacer, and despite the large number of faster and sleeker choices, what airplane could I possibly pick over the one that I have a key in my pocket for and that I get to fly every week? He says, I could say my favorite airplane is an SR-71, but it's kind of like saying my favorite food is something I saw on the menu, but I've never actually eaten. He says, so I'll stick with my humble Tri-Pacer as my favorite, knowing I'll be back in the left seat soon at my local grass strip, loving every minute of it. So thanks to Mike. You know, Mike, David, I don't know if you're aware of this. Mike is the guy behind the Why We Fly podcast. It's a pretty new podcast. It just started in January of this year. As of now, he's up to about episode 5. He says that Why We Fly, it's a general aviation podcast. They share pilot stories to inspire potential pilots to learn more about flying. So we appreciate Mike writing in and wish him the best with the Why We Fly podcast.
And I wrote to Mike because he seemed genuinely shocked that I know airplanes besides military airplanes. And I showed him why I'm so in love with the Piper Tri-Pacer, and it happens to be because there was a model of it. Monogram made a Piper Tri-Pacer, and growing up when I was a little kid, there weren't a lot of civilian aircraft in plastic models. There was always a lot of civilian aircraft in stick and tissue.
Mm.
But in plastic models, there was very limited. And one of them was a Piper Tri-Pacer that came with a couple of people. And I always thought it was a cute little airplane. And I sent him a link to show him what I thought of. And he went out, which was an eBay thing, and he went out and bid on it. But yeah, no, it was – people need to start realizing, Max, that I like airplanes. Everybody's so shocked when I say things like I like Tri-Pacers or Cessna 190s or – even Rob says that he just doesn't understand how I like airplanes so much. I'm like, because I like airplanes. It's called the Airplane Geek Show. It doesn't the Military Airplane Geek Show. So. Yeah. But it was pretty cool. You know, when I heard Piper Tri-Pacer, I'm like, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So.
All right. I'll just mention the website for the Why We Fly podcast. It's just simply whyweefly.org.
And I listened to a couple of the shows, and Mike's doing a really good job and a really good start. And here's to another 50 to 100 episodes, and see how long. And Mike, then you see how long you're going to endure this.
Yeah. One last item from Ryan Hothersall. Ryan sent along some photos of an E4. This is what you talked about last week, David.
Yep, that was the airplane of the week, the night watch aircraft, which is a Boeing 747-200. It was actually used by the Secretary of Defense when he visited Australia a couple years ago. And Ryan was fortunate enough to get lots of interesting pictures, including the very large self cargo door. So it really neat. So we'll put a link to the show notes in that. And thanks, Ryan, for sending those in.
Okay, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Want to thank all of you for listening. We also want to thank our guest this episode, Alan Schrader. He's the founder and CEO of Lightspeed Aviation. Learn more about them at lightspeedaviation.com. Well, let's tell everybody where they can find each of us. We'll start with you, David Vanderhoof. Where can folks find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. And of course, you can find me on Fridays with that guy, Max Flight, doing the UAV Digest.
And Rob Mark, how about you?
Well, anything that has jet wine in the title somewhere is probably us on Facebook or Twitter or jetwine.com or who knows where. So, but thanks. This was a great show, I think.
A lot of fun. Yes, a lot of fun. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David mentioned, at theuavdigest.com. Also on the PaxX podcast with Mary Kirby. Find us, of course, at airplanegeeks.com. You'll find links to us on social media there, as well as how to contact us. We also have a donate button there if you'd like to help support the show financially. Show notes are at airplanegeeks.com/390. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. We have an outro by Bruno Massone. Find his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Bye. We'll be right back.